that I wrote about this.
Dustin, I'm sorry. I want to go to John because, see, I said I would go from Joe to John and then to Dustin.
I'm going to agree with Joe. Where is the diversity in our leadership in this community? From our business organizations to our government to our school board, where is the diversity? And I think that Joe made a solid point. If you can't see somebody who looks like you, you lose all confidence. And I had a great conversation with an African-American woman about the first time some of these African-American students were going to colleges. And, you know, the students said, wow, they're, you know, they were going to the dorm and these African-American girls came out and apparently they were very sassy. And, you know, this one African-American student apparently told a teacher here in Kenosha Unified, wow, why are they so sassy? And the teacher turned around and said, no, honey, they're confident. And I think that we have to foster, we have to create an environment that fosters that confidence for our youth. And right now, our leadership isn't reflecting our demographics. So the moment we start to put people from the that reflects our demographics, the moment we might be able to see some of these changes made. And I think we should start to encourage. We should encourage members of our communities to stand up and to run for office and support them in their endeavor.
John, great point. I want to jump in. We're going to go to Dustin after this. But that is so true, because I was taught growing up that if I am too confident and too cocky, that people will say, well, that's an uppity N-word, right? Or you're too good for your britches. And if that's what it takes, I mean, I don't give a damn what they think. You know, I am confident in my abilities and what I can do and my talents. And but you're so right. I've had people in my life who've instilled that in me, and not to be afraid to believe that about myself. Dustin.
Something I wrote this morning, because I was getting so tired of people, you know, saying, why do we keep having this problem? And this is what I've been telling people for probably 5 years now. Vote so you can define the government that you, you know, we keep saying, where are all the leaders? Where's the business involvement? People, yep. If we're not voting for people who share those common beliefs that we do, we're going to not change things. And then we can protest all we want. It's not going to change unless we get to the ballot box. That's which right. Then brings us to the next point. Run for office. You can be the change maker. You won't get anything accomplished, because the people, the protests you can do all you want will fall on deaf ears until we see elected leaders who change us. And we have leaders like that. You know, leaders like, I called Monica Yuhas yesterday and talked a little bit about how can we get things rolling. Because I attended the meeting when they were talking about you know, a position on diversity, and I heard, you know, I heard county board supervisors say that systemic racism doesn't exist. I heard our own county supervisors say that. So I called Monica Yuhas and I said, Monica, how can we get things changed? How can we get body cams out there? And on the city, put pressure on the city council. They passed a resolution, I think, in 2017 to put body cams on police officers. They're not on, body cams are not on our police officers in Kenosha. And then donate. So anytime you see an ally running for office, $5, $10, but vote, run, and donate. That's how we're going to see these changes happen. That we won't do anything else. We can protest all we want. We can have conversations all we want. But until we take action, we're not going to see any of the changes we want.
That's a great point, Dustin. John Lewis said famously that you need an inside and an outside game.
That's right.
Lyndon Johnson was famous for bringing Martin Luther King into the White House and saying, okay, I believe everything you're saying to me, but go out there and make me do it. Right. Yeah. And so you need leaders on the inside who are going to be willing to bring those people to the table, hear them, listen to them, and implement policy. But you also need people on the outside. Right. And I've heard a lot of people say, well, you know, if I vote for such and such candidate, that's all they want from me. Like, no, voting is like the first step in the political process. Yes. It's the following up afterwards. Democracy is a participatory event. It's something you continually do every single day to keep this democracy.
Not every 4 years. As right. John Lewis said, folks, we can raise a lot of good trouble.
That's right. Good it's our duty trouble. To raise good trouble. It's our duty as civilians to raise good trouble. And, you know, I think it's interesting because a lot of our leaders right now see these protests as maybe a bad thing, but in some ways it's a beautiful thing. They're holding our community accountable, which is good. We should be endorsing it.
I do want to tell you that most of the leaders that I spoke, because I have been on the phone nonstop with leaders across our community, and there's not one of them. Well, there's a couple, but there's not many that think that the protests are a bad thing. Mm-hmm. A lot of it are the rioting and the looting and the destruction of the community. But unfortunately, I think almost saturates the message.
Exactly.
You know, so many of the protesters that I've spoken to have said, we want them out. We're pushing them out because we want our message not to be diluted. And so I just to go on the record,
Thanks for clarifying, are
supportive of the conversation that's going to be had, I hope.
I want to go to Dominic and bring him back in because you are a sitting alderman who received a lot of those complaints from citizens about the neighborhood, their concerns. As you mentioned before our talk here today, your district is kind of all over the place, the 16th district, but you've had concerns from people across the city. What have you heard from citizens? And of course, their thoughts on the protests and then how they expect you as an alderman to respond.
Most of the time, they just want to talk to somebody. Mm-hmm. I had a couple of elderly women call me crying. They're afraid. They're afraid to leave their houses. They're afraid of what's going to happen if they leave their houses. And that's no way to live. A peaceful protest is one thing. Violence, destruction of property is out of control. Out of control. One of the saddest things I've seen when I was driving around, it was today, as a matter of fact. Somebody had boarded up a store with apartments upstairs. Mm-hmm. And on that board, they said, children live here. Like, please don't burn the business down. I have kids living upstairs. So they're living in fear. It's not a good thing. No. It's not a good thing. This thing has been coming to a head. And now I think it's ahead. To get to the point earlier, in Chicago, they have a female black mayor. They have a police chief of color. And they're one of the most violent places on earth. It's in the heart. You know, there's a lot of violence, a lot of drug addicts, a lot of drug users, a lot of drug dealers. Dustin could certainly shine on that. I know a lot about alcoholism and drug abuse, a lot. I spend many, many hours at first steps. Okay, I know what the people are going through. I feel their pain. They just want hope. The citizens of Kenosha want hope.
No, they went change.
Yeah, things are going to get better. Things are going to get better for them.
You know? To kind of piggyback off what Dominic said, that leads to another equity discussion that we have to have, which is the allocation of resources.
Yeah.
That's another role. Absolutely. You know, as an independent kind of advocate, I don't really like to, like the Kevin Mathewsons or the Kyle Floods, where they kind of brand themselves as ambassadors of whatever. I just like to silently address the issues because I believe one-on-one conversations are more effective in seeing that change. And one of the things that we have this real big issue is allocation of resources. And Chicago is an absolute, I think, dynamite example of where you see as soon as you cross Cicero Avenue and the south side of Chicago, that's where the resources deplete. And actually, next week I'm meeting with a young man named Tommy Adams, who is building a business on the south side of Chicago. And he is hoping to inspire change. And he mentors young adults because he's 34, he's a felon, and he wants to use his own story. It was amazing to inspire young adults to step up, build their communities. And he said, because you know what? Those of us from the south side, we emulate the superstars that kind of saturate our communities. And so we see drugs, we see, hustle, we see fancy car. That's what we work for. We don't work for things that the white man is taught to achieve. We're taught to just hustle and make it good while it lasts. And he's like, I want to change that. And I just, it was just such an eye-opening conversation I had with him that I was like, man, I want to meet you. I want to tour your neighborhood. I want to hear your story more because I want to do more in fighting for allocation of resources.
Dominic, I think you actually have a great point that representation is one thing. It's great to have people in power like a Lori Lightfoot and the chief of police, I think, who came from Dallas, Texas, who's now in Chicago. But it's another thing to have those policies implemented. But, and I'll toss this to, I was going to go to John, but I'll go to Peter here. It's one thing to have the leaders in place if they don't have the resources to implement. And then there's generational things here. I mean, we saw with the building of the highway system in Chicago, how that basically just tore through a lot of those self-sustaining neighborhoods at one time, including Italian and other neighborhoods in Chicago. So your talk about, I think Dominic has an excellent point about, hey, we have Black leaders. We've had a Black president of the United States in Barack Obama, and yet we're still dealing with some of these issues. What would you say to that, Peter?
I think it's, that is a hefty question. With my expertise as a political science major, I think Joe made a beautiful point about how progress, I think progress in society is kind of like a treadmill. If you stop walking, you lose it pretty quickly. you have to keep grinding away at it. And that's a battle that it's kind of like a race where you have to constantly hand off that baton. And I think it's progress doesn't happen overnight, doesn't happen in a day. We've seen, I think, in the wake of George Floyd, seen some changes happening in certain cities, but also a lot of resistance. And I think with the Black leadership, that is essential for building up these areas in the country, just the U.S. as a whole, of showing this more leadership. It kind of reminds me of something I learned in one of my sociology classes, where people talk about the American dream, and they always talk about Bill Gates, like Warren Buffett, Mark Zuckerberg. And my professor brought up, he said, so this is an American dream that we're all supposed to share. How come we can name individuals? Why is it so rare that we can name individuals? Obama was a Black president. The mayor of Chicago is a Black mayor. They're not the president, who also just happens to be Black. Mm-hmm. And it's such a, I think it is kind of the exception to the rule in most places. We point to that. We point the finger, kind of. I think it's easy to fall into that trap of, well, look there. They have that a Black person in power, and they're still struggling.
Yep.
But it's a new thing. The fact that it's not a consistent thing that is shared, that has continued to go on. Just like kind of how like the school administration, you get some people of color in, but if you don't have people constantly fighting for that, it quickly goes back to white. And I wish I had a better insight into this. And I do think, though, you see a lot of culture is something that takes a long time to shift. And I think we've shifted a lot in a very positive way through having Obama as the president, but also there were some difficulties that, I mean, people have reservations about his administration. And I don't really know exactly how Black leadership is supposed to cause a massive change, but it's not just having a president. If you look at state governments, almost every single state government is Republican, which I don't want to make this a right-left issue, but that is inherent. That's a local issue. And in local politics, it tends to lead conservative, which is fine. But there are voices that aren't being heard. In cities, it tends to be more progressive. And other areas, it's not. And I think that's an issue where getting out to vote, I know it seems like you're filling out a piece of paper and you're putting it in, but or calling your congressman. I think there's a website that's like fivecalls.org or something like that. It's a progressive website, so just know that going into it. But it's so easy. You put in your zip code, and it tells you who your congressmen are. Some websites go into your local. Call them. Like, that is something that really does make a difference if they know that people are concerned about them in their community and they're people who are going to vote.
And I think, Peter, to your point, I think we need white allies to speak on black issues too, because a lot of times, oh, well, that's just the black constituency, you know, who cares anyways? So we need white allies to stand with us for and say, I care about black lives too. I care about the uptown neighborhood, just like I care about my neighborhood. And when we can create that kind of, and I think that's why the protests this time around are being so successful, are so different, because you're seeing white people and young millennials, Gen Z, who are like, I'm not going to take this, because they've grown up in a world where they've had black friends, they've seen black people on television, they've engaged with black people in a way that others have not traditionally in the past. And to be fair, there were a lot of white people in the original 1960s movement as well, but you're seeing just even more. A lot more today. Dustin, I want to go back to your point about allocation of resources, because I want to move the conversation into things that we can do. Joe, we've talked about kind of bringing in onboarding people of color in different leadership positions. And I'll go to Dustin after my point. You know, when someone says, you know, I'm going to hire you down here, right? But I'm not going to promote you. You're not just hurting the person who's being promoted. You're hurting that person's family, their children, because they're going to lose all of that income, that wage, the wages that they could earn. So when you refuse to appoint or bring in African-American people, it doesn't just hurt the community then and now. Nope. It creates a generational legacy and part of why we are here today. So Dustin, as we move the conversation into kind of what we can do, what are real solutions here? You talked about allocation of resources. Is it, and you mentioned the individual in Chicago who you're going to go see, the entrepreneur, how can businesses and business capital be more effective in giving to black businesses fairly and equitably?
Well, let's start from before that. Let's talk about education outcomes. We look at Milwaukee Public Schools, and I serve on a school board, and I work with the Milwaukee Public School Board of Education members. There, a lot of them have very different ideas for what they want for education, but they all have a unified effort of, we want to make sure our students are prepared. But we look at the allocation of dollars. Now, they receive a lot of money from state, and then they receive a lot of money from tax, from local property taxpayers, because Milwaukee County has a large tax basis. But if you, I visited Milwaukee Public Schools during the Wisconsin Association of School Boards meeting, and I went to two schools, and they were both international baccalaureate schools. And the one question I asked is, well, how do students go in here? How do students get here? Well, there's a rigorous application process. And it was very startling, because the breakdown of the student body in those schools was still not representative of the population of the city of Milwaukee or the Unified School District. So we even start earlier than that, healthcare. How are we investing into healthcare into urban communities? And I don't like to use that word, because I think that any neighborhood you live in should be a safe neighborhood. It should be a great neighborhood to raise a family, go to work, but I digress. We look at healthcare outcomes in urban communities. The amount of hospitals per capita, or the amount of clinics per capita versus a rural community or a suburban community. We look at schools. We look at the investment in those schools. We look at the staff that makes up those schools. The teachers, how many are new teachers? How many are tenured teachers? How long has the principal been there? How many school counselors do they have? What's the security look like in that school? The breakdown that creates the pattern for that child to not only learn, but to grow and to develop social patterns. We look at the breakdown of public libraries. How many libraries and what kind of resources do they have? That is what shapes a child's journey and how they live their life, because it develops what they can achieve and what outcomes that they see is their hope. And then the parent situation at home. What are mom and dad, or mom or dad, what kind of situation are they creating for their child at home based on the resources that are in the community? So before we even address what the business community can do, look at the neighborhoods that children are growing up into, because that is more than likely the future that they feel that they can only achieve because they haven't known anything differently.
So could I just jump in? This is one way you can bring the community together. Educators know that children, before they get to first grade, in poverty-stricken areas, children of color will hear 30 million fewer words than children who are in predominantly white areas. So we instituted universal four-year-old kindergarten during my time as superintendent across the board in the state of Wisconsin. It used to be just five-year-old kindergarten. I would always meet with the Head Start teachers, three-year-old students, children, four-year-old kindergarten, five-year-old kindergarten, and I would say, I'm going to shut up and listen. I'm not going to say a word for the first half hour. Tell me what you need. They needed readers. So I went to Parkside, went to Gateway, went to Carthage, and Carthage came through. And Greg Woodward, the chancellor, gave us 100 students, juniors and seniors at Carthage, who would be readers 1 hour a day from 3 until 4 o'clock, Monday through Thursday. The chancellor deducted $2,000 off of their tuition for every semester that those 100 students, and they needed 100 hours of community service anyway. So does Gateway. I don't know about Parkside. But here you go. You bring in college juniors and seniors to read with kids in inner city schools. And they're, before they even hit first grade, they will at least have a fighting chance. And so Milwaukee, Justin, you're right, and Madison, I don't know if you can see this, has the Grumps. The Grumps are Grandparents United for the Madison Public Schools, Grandparents United for the Milwaukee Public Schools. Right, they're the Grumps. Kenosha could have the Grunks or whatever, but grandparents in the inner city are oftentimes the glue. Yes. Single moms.
Yes.
Kids, dads in prison are out of the picture. It's grandma and grandpa that are bringing kids to school, that are picking them up after the day. They are the glue. So use them, hire them, make them part of the equation. Look at all of the resources we have. Are we using Parkside, Carthage, and Gateway? Can they help? Can our senior citizens help? We're not a throwaway demographic. We're still here alive and kicking. So there are ways and means of bringing the community together and using the resources that are out there, bringing up everybody together to solve the problem.
That's a beautiful thing. I didn't even know it was happening in our community. So thank you for helping make that happen.
I don't know if it still is, Peter, because that's like just what you said. It's a treadmill.
Yeah.
And if you don't have somebody who continues with the progress for whatever reason, it stops. And once it starts, it's like, who's the guy in Greek mythology that kept pushing the rock up to the top of the mountain?
Oh, not Atlas. Oh.
Who was that? Sisyphus? That's what it feels like. If you don't give people a boost, you're back to square one so easily.
One thing that I think is going to be harder to change, we have about 30 minutes left here in our programming today. Thank you so much for joining us on this very special edition of Generation Now, Kenosha Will Rise. Right after this, you're going to be hearing Community Matters with Len Iaquinta. If you are listening, if you are watching, then the video is just going to end and you'll go on watching cat videos or whatever you do after this. Hopefully, after this, you'll be inspired to learn a little bit more about how we can all come together and help underserved communities, underserved people in our community. I want to continue the discussion of what we are going to do from here. We've talked about the allocation.
I apologize. My grandkids are downtown painting boards. And so I promised I would join them. So thank you guys. I'm glad I was part of this. I hope we can do this again. I feel like I've made 6 new friends. So God bless you guys.
Yes, Joe Mangi. Joe Mangi, thank you so much. Joe Mangi, the former superintendent of Kenosha Unified Schools, joining us today. Thank you so much, Joe. So I'll toss this to the rest of the panel here. We talked about the allocation of resources, which are also very important. And I'll start with Dominic here. How do we change the hearts and minds, because it seems like we're creating this treadmill effect, as Joe and Peter have alluded to, because when people have a difference of opinion, they kind of, the whole system goes under. How do we make sure that we implant in people's hearts and minds that when we're allocating resources, we're not attacking people, we're trying to create equality for all, and that's something we all should aspire to do?
I think it comes to role models. Everybody has role models in life. We try to act like our role models. And if our role models aren't on the up and up, they think that's okay, you know? We have resources. There are many areas in town that are underserved, or they appear to be underserved. Maybe they are, and maybe they're not. You know, the Brass area had the Make It Safe grocery store. Well, they had to close because of theft. You know, that's the reason why it closed. You know, it was an awesome idea to put it in the Brass neighborhood, but it didn't work out. Why? You know, people have to realize that there is. You could better yourself. You could better yourself doing anything in life. You know, like I said before, you have to realize that you have worth. You know, worth, self-respect, worth. You know, the city of Kenosha is a great town. Sure, it has its problems, but people like myself are here to listen and to try to make it better. Not just for one class of people, for the whole city. You know, we're only strong as our weakest link. You know, our school system is great. You know, our friends down in Illinois, you know, they come up here, they're amazed of how good our school system is and how much resources that we have. You know, I raised three children in the Kenosha Unified School District. My daughter is a teacher in a unified, you know, and the opportunities seem to be there. You know, maybe it's a misconception that the opportunities aren't there for everybody else. And maybe they are. You know, maybe you know, family is a big thing too. Family. You have to have a strong family. Otherwise, you get into trouble, and trouble makes trouble. So.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I want to push back, because I think it's and of course I respect you and thank you for being on the panel, and I don't want to cause friction, but I think it could be problematic to some that one retail outlet, you know, in one side of town could change, you know, 500 years or 100 years or 50 years of strife. I mean, of course, we need those efforts. I'm not saying that Pick-A-Save should never have been in that area. We need that. We need businesses to invest in that area. But I think that's hard to put that all on, you know, the retailer. The retailer obviously also has business objectives that they have to complete, oblige by. And I totally get that. But I think that's unfair to say that, oh, well, you know, just because the store was there, you know, that, oh, that should have been the saving grace of that community, or that could have been a bigger help. John, I see your hand up here, so I want to get to you.
Yeah, I just am going to expand on that. You know, we really have got to ask the people within these communities what they need, and we need to actively listen. And I think that the issue that we've had in this city, in this community, is we've sometimes not actively listened and engaged with the community that we serve. And I think that, you know, like Troy was saying, we need to do a lot more than just putting a pick and save into, you know, that area, that community. And it's, you know, unfortunate that our community hasn't invested a lot of effort and thought into the idea of how to make that part of town better, quite frankly. And I guess it's just alarming. I mean, some of the things, I guess, that I've heard come out of the mouths of people is, it's just alarming. That's all.
Dustin, I want to go to you about your thoughts on the conversation we're having.
I think it's challenging because, with the exception of yourself, Troy, none of us have experienced what we are theorizing is the solution to the problem. We just haven't. We can summarize, and I graduated with 2 degrees, criminal justice, political science. Basically, I was trained to think and to interpret how people come to make decisions. But, you know, we are taught that shoplifting is generally due to blight in the community, is to opportunity. So shoplifting is a crime of opportunity, and is generally a reflection of the community of which that store might be in. But that doesn't justify why we see theft in prime outlets in Pleasant Prairie. And so it goes to a deeper issue of what are we missing? Are we missing economic opportunity for families in the Brass neighborhood? Are we seeing the lack of investment into jobs that are local? Investment into transportation for access to other services. There's a myriad of issues, but until we sit down and we have a list of changes we need from people in those neighborhoods. And I'm not talking about the representative, because Zach Rodriguez, who's the county board supervisor, and I don't know who the city council member for that area is, but I mean, they can come up with a list all day of things. But until we hear from neighbors in that district and a real conversation across communities in the city of Kenosha, not just the Brass neighborhood, not just Dominick's district, not just the downtown Civic Park neighborhoods, until we have a whole conversation and see real solutions that we need. Because I can come up with all days, let's put $1 million into job training into that neighborhood. Let's put more street cars. Let's put up more street lights. Let's put up bodegas of little, gas station, gas little corner shops like they have in New York City. I can do that all day long. But until we hear, and John talked about this, until Peter a little bit too, until we know what they need to succeed, then we're just going to be spinning our wheels here and having great conversations.
Dustin, it's interesting that you say that because, finding out that list, there was a meeting I covered years ago, and it was the Frank Neighborhood Project was having an event with police at the Boys and Girls Club. And Peter, I'm going to go to you after this. Usually that Boys and Girls Club was packed. They would have food giveaways and food drives, and people would come and, take family food for their families, and they'd go. But when the police were there and he tried to create this community event, they did not show up. And I forgot the organizer of the Frank Neighborhood Project, I forgot his name.
Pastor Harris.
Pastor Harris, thank you so much, Pastor Harris. He ranted and said, I give food for this community and I'm trying to bridge the gap here, and I don't know how to do it. So I think it's also fair, because I understand the frustration that some white people have. It's a frustration within the Black community as well of how we bridge the middle class African Americans who have somehow managed to achieve class success, even though there's still underlying racial issues. I'm not negating that. Having money helps, but it doesn't eviscerate racism, as I alluded with my chicken and waffle story. It still happens. But at the same time, we're having that struggle as well. And Peter, I'm going to go to you after I make this point. What was interesting is I was watching the live streams of the looting that was going on. And one of the videos I saw was at a Family Dollar. And I was looking at, of course, it's, this business, it's unfortunate, sad that what happened. But I was looking at what they were grabbing. And they were grabbing toilet paper. And these are young kids. These are millennials, Gen Z, who are grabbing laundry detergent, toilet paper, household items for their families. And so I just thought, wow, that's interesting. Of course, looting is terrible, but I think we're also not talking about why they're there. And I mean, the items they're grabbing spoke volumes. I'm curious about, from the footage you saw and your opinion on what happened there.
So I think that definitely speaks to an issue of just not really understanding what is going on. And from what I mean by that is the context by which other people live their lives. I have never in my life questioned living to at least 70 years old. That was just a guarantee. Yes, I know there's disease and whatnot, but I've never once thought, man, like, I might get shot to death. I might overdose on the wrong drugs. So I have friends who their family members were gunned down. He was 14 when his brother was killed. And just last week, his cousin was shot to death in Racine. Like, and that, the context by which they're living is, it's not, how am I going to plan for retirement? It's, how am I going to eat this week? How am I going to get through tomorrow? One of my black friends from high school, just the concept of going home and not having food in your cabinet, just, the only times I've ever been hungry are when I just either forgot to eat or intentionally was not eating. Like, hunger for me is a novelty, not a reality. And just, if you're hungry, how are you supposed to do anything else? Like, no pun intended, it consumes you, because it both literally and figuratively, your mind can only think of one thing. And that's where I think throughout this conversation, we've really been echoing the idea of providing the support and the resources people need. Just, we're not saying give these people the moon and the stars. We're saying give these people like food, housing, and opportunity and support. We're not saying give them money. We're not just going to hand them over money. We're just saying give these people at least the baseline that you had your entire life to work with. And I think watching the videos, that has actually been hard for me. I think when you're watching national news, you're watching Portland, it's kind of this funny thing, like, oh, like, look at the protesters, look at the riot police, like, yada yada. Well, it's your hometown. I have friends who are on the police force and texting them, checking in on them. I have friends who are going to the protests. Like, it's not very one side for me. It's hard for me because I'm scared for both of them. Yeah. And watching the protests has been quite emotional for me, because it's literally just like watching your childhood burn. Like, just like, oh yeah, I used to go there and now it's on fire. Like, oh yeah, I always used to walk by that place. It's on fire. Like, I don't know. Me and my friends were freaking out. Like, is Frank's Diner okay? Like, is Frank's burnt down? Because that's not only just important to us, that's a historical place for us. Like, that's been around for almost like 100 years now. And it sounds kind of silly talking about, like, oh, is the diner okay? But like, I have had countless great conversations and meals shared with people who I love there. And it's kind of like breaking your phone and losing all your photos. Like, my childhood town is being broken. And I think there's just a lot of emotion inside of me, and just trying to keep in mind all of these things of just the lens that these people are viewing their life through is not the same lens I have. And I think that's something that's hard to remember is why would you expect them to live the life in the way you are when they were never given the opportunity or even the choice of the same? I'm kind of stumbling over my words and I apologize, but just kind of, I'm getting emotional. I apologize. But just like, these people don't have getting to 30 isn't a guarantee. Right. So why would you expect them to live a life in a way where they would be building towards their future and their community? Because that's just not something that is a guarantee for them.
Peter, I want to jump in, and then I'm going to go to John. I don't think I've shared this publicly on the radio, so this is a scoop. I grew up people know that I grew up in tremendous, you know, poverty. My mom was a single mom. The most she ever made in her life in working was $33,000 a year. And so there were many days where, you know, we wouldn't eat. And there were many times I would get up at 5 a.m. before school, and we'd go to our computer and we'd log in if our internet was on. Otherwise we'd have to call on the home phone to see if my father's child support check came through of $101.63. And I remember the exact amount, because if that money didn't come on a Wednesday, that meant by Thursday, or for that Wednesday's lunch, I was not going to have lunch, because I had reduced lunch. And so I paid like 75 cents. If I didn't have that 75 cents, I wasn't going to eat that day, and I wasn't going to eat dinner. And there were many occasions, I can't even count, probably 10 or 15 times, where I would come home and our electric was cut off and our cable was cut off. And we've had furniture repossessed. I mean, it was just, a very hard living. And so you are so right, Peter, that I grew up in an environment where it really wasn't even about getting through school, even though I loved school and I was good at it. But, and that really was my saving grace and my mother's support, because all I had was my mother telling me that I could make it, that I was not going to be, I didn't have to succumb to these circumstances. She always told me I could achieve better. But if I grow up in a home, as so many of African-Americans do, where they don't feel like they have those resources, and even if they do, there's people who are in positions who don't want to elevate us and give us that shot so we can earn that way, it creates that cycle of, you know what, I've given up. I had a coworker, and then I'm gonna go to John, who told me, who's an African-American, he said, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die. That's just reality. And here's a young man, he's 28, who is already preparing to die.
Yeah.
Already preparing to die because of the circumstances he's in. That was a very astute point. John, I want to bring you in here.
Yeah, and I think, I don't think a lot of our community has that voice that believes in them. And I think that you emphasized it so well, that we need to give that hope. And as leaders in our community, we should be doing that. We should be giving hope to every citizen. Furthering Peter's point, you know, that, yeah, poverty is real. And these people are going from check to check, kind of like Troy, as you stated, it happened in your youth. And so we have to help them, give them that opportunity so that they can get out of that situation, causing less of these unfortunate situations of crime. And we have to be able to also, and this is something that we haven't talked about in this community particularly, is we have to recognize that mental health is becoming a crisis.
Yep.
And that has played a big role on what happened here, on both sides, on both sides. We have to remember that the stress that the police are under very well could have triggered this man to maybe, perhaps he was in having a bad day, but there's certainly mental health implications in all of this. And we have to see, how do we start to talk about mental health and how do we approach it? Do we start talking about it in the schools? Do we start talking about it within work? But that's a discussion that I'd like to see start, and start soon, because that affects everything.
Right, and you're so right. But we also, before we can even have that discussion, which is a valued one, we have to talk about the stigma of what that means to have depression or OCD or post-traumatic stress. I still believe, and I have not been clinically diagnosed, but I still believe that I have traumatic stress reactions from growing up in poverty, right? I feel like the rug could be pulled out for me at any time, so I don't hold on to things because I'm afraid of, well, someone's going to take it away, because that's what always happened continuously throughout my life, right? So when you're in that kind of walking on eggshells type thing, that is a traumatic stress, right? And so that's built into racism as well. I think people think about the comments, but they don't think about the structural feeling of being unsafe and unsound in your community. Dustin, I want to bring you in on what John just said about the mental health aspect. You deal with, obviously, folks at the Shalom Center who you combine and connect them with mental health resources.
So two things I want to quickly talk about. First is, John, you brought up a point about, raising the bar economically for communities of color. I would take that one step forward, raising the bar for families across Wisconsin. We have a wealth gap in this country. We have an economic access gap in this country. And certainly we have a challenge with rising costs of living and stagnant rises in wages. And so take that for what you will. I don't want to make any political comments on that. But moving to your next point, Troy, your question about how do we address that? Absolutely. Everyone here is absolutely on point about the mental health crisis. And that's what we have to, it's a public health crisis. We have just an abounding stigma of associated with having a mental illness. People are shunned. People don't want to talk about it. It's, well, just get over it. Rub some dirt on it. You'll be fine. Just get a good night's sleep. You'll be fine in the morning. And so that stigma is what we have to break apart. And I think the Carter Center, named after Jimmy Carter, and Rosalind Carter's Mental Health Institute have been doing great work in making strides in breaking apart stigma associated with mental health. And I think we have to, because John, you kind of alluded to it. We don't know what kind of training that officer had in terms of dealing with de-escalation. We don't know what kind of training or even mental health checks. One of the organizations I work with outside of Shalom Center is an organization that advocates for the health and well-being in terms of mental health across the country. And one of the focuses last year of the strategic plan was having conversations with